Support for WPR comes from Isthmus Partners, an asset management firm providing comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for long-term growth and capital preservation. More at isthmuspartnersllc.com. Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at the in-demand tech gifts this holiday season, from tablets to fitness bands and everything in between.
First, financial regulators approved a long-delayed measure earlier today that would impose tougher restrictions on banks and financial institutions.
The Volcker Rule, named after the former Federal Reserve Chairman, is a key part of 2010's Dodd-Frank Act, but just came up for a vote today among regulators after years of lobbying on both sides. Supporters say the rule would prevent future taxpayer-funded bailouts. Our next guest says the law is a lesson in how complicated simplifying Wall Street can be.
Joining us now to explain what the rule is and how it would work is Yalman Anaran, senior writer at Bloomberg News.
Yalman, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Paul Volcker's name has become attached to this rule. What was he originally proposing and what was he hoping to accomplish?
Well, it's been many years, 4 years actually, when he first came up with this idea in 2009. Obama wasn't even sworn in yet. He was about to be as president. And Volcker was suggesting that risky trading by the largest banks is not allowed to be part of their institutions. That way, the riskiest stuff would be separated and done by hedge funds or other, you know, institutions that whose blow up and meltdown would not be necessarily a concern of taxpayers and governments. And that's how the idea started 4 years ago.
And this is in the aftermath of the economic meltdown in 2008. And I guess the idea is, these normal banks that are supposed to be doing boring stuff, a lot of people think, got themselves too leveraged on these exotic investments. Is that right?
Yes. Of course, you know, after the Great Depression, we passed Glass-Steagall, Congress passed Glass-Steagall to separate investment banking and all types of trading activities from the boring commercial banking, which is you take deposits and you lend it out to companies and consumers. And that was the rule for six decades, at least. And then sort of in the 90s, it was softened and Citigroup was buying all these other companies and banks. And then finally in 99, Congress repealed Glass-Steagall and allowed the financial conglomerates to do whatever they felt like doing. And part of the problems with the crisis, when we saw all the biggest banks being in trouble and some of them had to be rescued by the government, was that they had done a lot of risky trading with derivatives and all these very wonderful, sophisticated securities, you know, collateralized debt obligations and things like that, whose names we had never heard before until the crisis, and where everybody, they became household names.
So it seems pretty simple to just say there will be some banks that handle the normal individual and commercial type things, and there will be separate investment banks that will do that more complicated high-risk stuff. But it's taken a few years to get to the point where we are today in setting the rules. Why is it so much more complicated than it might look at first blush?
Because this is not as straightforward separating everything Glass-Steagall, the way Glass-Steagall did after the Great Depression. Now, Volcker himself said, well, times are different, everything is more up-to-date, modern, and we can't tell the banks they cannot really do any investment banking. The brokerage and helping their clients do trades is part of their business. They can continue doing that. They just shouldn't be part of the betting that goes on, you know, whether interest rates will go up or down or whether, you know, markets are going to go up or down. They should really not do that part. So this is not as straightforward, not as clean cut. And so trying to get to that has been tough.
That sounds like it's going to be kind of difficult to untangle and enforce, right? We're saying banks, yes, you can do these kind of investments for your clients and to hedge against certain kinds of risks, but you can't do the other kind. Is there a real strong gray area in there that's going to be hard to enforce?
the enforcement is going to be pretty it's going to be a nightmare, yes, because if the rules have certain definitions and restrictions and what's allowed and what's not allowed. But at the end, it really is up to the supervisors, to the banking regulators and the market regulators. There are five agencies involved in all this to make sure that it really the institutions are following the spirit of the rule. And that's not going to be easy, and I'm sure it's going to require lots of people. And banks have to hire lots of extra compliance officers and make sure they're doing things the right way. So it's going to be interesting going forward.
The reaction I've seen from some of the big Wall Street-type banks is, you know what, we're already pretty close to being in compliance here. We've gotten out of that line of trade. Is that true?
Well, all the big banks shut down what they all called prop trading desks, and that was very narrow, very specific, focused on let's bet how things are going to happen. And they were separated from the rest of the trading operation, but they were small. I mean, a lot of them, they were 1-2% of their total trading operations. The biggest place where prop trading really happens and where these kind of risks might still be taking place is where they are supposed to be helping their clients, which is market making, it's called, and that's when they buy or sell all kinds of different assets and securities with the aim, supposedly, of helping their customers, which are hedge funds and institutional funds and asset management firms. But while they're doing that, they could still be taking risk by holding those things too long or buying more than they really need to buy for their clients. So the Volcker rule is supposed to ratchet that down and say, no, you need to really focus on the client and not try to make money, quick money, on the side of that, because that can end up piling up lots of risk and in the aggregate, and then we end up bailing you out.
So in effect, sort of, if Robco, my new business that doesn't exist, went into the bank and said, here's some of my money, you can invest it in these things and that's fine, that would still be allowed. But the bank can't then say, yeah, and we're going to set up some quick side hedge funds to make an extra 1.3% out of Rob's money while he's waiting for his return. That last part might be out of the picture then.
Yes, that's part of the rule, that banks actually cannot run their own hedge funds and their investment funds. They can invest very small portions in the hedge funds that they might have helped set up for clients. And also when they're helping their clients trade, let's say the client says, I want to sell, 100 shares of IBM, and the bank says, okay, I'll take that, but I don't have anyone else who's willing to buy 100 shares. So they hold on to those 100 shares for a while, but the goal needs to be, according to the rule now, that you get rid of those 100 shares as soon as you can. You don't wait saying, maybe IBM is going to get really valuable in the next year, so let's hope, wait and make money on that. It's like you're helping your client by taking the shares because nobody else wants it at that moment, but the first chance you get, you're supposed to get rid of it.
Most of us experience banks by depositing our paychecks, maybe getting a mortgage or car loan from our banks. How much are these new rules going to affect most of us who aren't dealing with these big number, more risky investments?
It should not affect us in that way. But, of course, the biggest problem, again, is the banks where we turn to for our mortgages and for putting our money and being safe, et cetera. We trust that they're always there when we want to take our money out. Last crisis, we saw that without government stepping in and putting hundreds of billions of dollars of capital and trillions of dollars of emergency cash from the Federal Reserve, they could not survive, and our money might not have been there when we wanted to take it out. So we rely on these banks, and we trust that they're always going to be fine. So the government now wants to make sure that while they're making that system safe, they don't have to dabble in these big risky, every 3 seconds revolving trades and end up securing those and backing those as well.
So I won't see a day-to-day difference, but maybe my bank is a little less risky then.
That's the idea.
So you mentioned Glass-Steagall as a more simple alternative. Are people still pushing for that, for having an even firmer line than the Volcker Rule between deposit-type banks and investment banks?
Some people still do. The FDIC vice chairman, Tom Honig, for example, has argued that that's really what we need to do, still go back to Glass-Steagall and separate investment banking from plain vanilla banking. There have been every congressional session, basically there's been one proposal, bipartisan, from Republican and Democrat backings, but small groups of people saying, let's go back to Glass-Steagall. It hasn't gone anywhere. There was one time it faced a vote, maybe 2009 or 10, and it didn't pass, and it didn't garner enough support even in the Senate, and didn't even come up in the House. So that idea hasn't died, but it clearly doesn't have enough political backing out there to really become reality. So this is why it's sort of the second best.
Yalman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yalman Anaran is a senior writer at Bloomberg News.
The holiday shopping season is in full swing. Chances are that at least one person on your list is going to want something in the high-tech gadget category.
But as always, there's a ton of choices out there, and it can be tough to know what's going to be a hit under the tree and what's going to be a flop.
Here to point us in the direction of some cool technology gifts is Omar Gayaga. He's technology culture reporter at the Austin American Statesman. Omar, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with tablets, if you will. They've been a popular gift the last few years, as I understand it. Is the iPad still the big name, or are there other tablets on the market that that might trump them in gift buying this year?
Yeah, tablets are still very hot. PCs, you know, traditional PCs, laptops, and desktops are slowing down, and tablets are continuing to grow. Microsoft has made a really big push this year with its Surface 2 tablets. But iPad really is the one that I continue to recommend. The iPad Air, which is lighter and thinner than last year's model at about the same price, it continues to dominate. There are some great tablets on the Android side, but really the iPad continues to dominate on the tablet side at least.
What about tablets for kids?
There's actually one that I've been recommending called the Nobby Junior, Nick Junior Edition, which is a very kid-friendly tablet. It's kind of rubberized, so it doesn't fall and break like my iPad have with my kids. It costs $140. Yeah, they break very easily in the hands of four-year-olds. For $140, it's branded with Dora the Explorer and a lot of the Nick Junior characters. It's internet safe. It blocks off internet content and has apps that are meant for that age group, you know, between 3 and about 7 to 8 years old. So that's a good one for that age group.
Before we move on from the tablets, just wanted to get your take on why the iPad. There's a lot on the market. Why is that still the top choice and why you're recommending it?
Well, really because it got there first. I mean, it got the advantage of being the first really good, solid tablet at around that price range, and there have just been so many good apps developed for it that Microsoft and on the Android side, there really aren't as many good tablet apps for the competitors than there are for the iPad. And every year, Apple continues to come out with, you know, faster versions of it, thinner versions of it, lighter versions of it, and keeping it at the same price. And now there's the iPad Mini, which, you know, for I believe it's $299, you know, you get the same Retina display, the same amount of apps, but in the smaller, lighter form. So, I mean, really, Apple is kind of running the table on tablets, and, you know, Microsoft's products on the Surface side just really haven't kept up. So I think, you know, there's definitely more competition this year than there was last year, but the iPad continues to be the one that dominates, that you just see everywhere and that people continue to buy.
And then any favorites in the Android world if people, for whatever reason, aren't sold on the iPad?
Yeah, the Samsung Galaxy Tab is a really good one. I believe it's a little bit less expensive than the iPad. And all of the Amazon Kindle tablets are very, very competitively priced. I mean, you can get an Amazon Kindle Fire for about half the price of an iPad Air. And, you know, it's not going to run as many apps. It's going to be more for consumption of media than creating media. But for most people that just want to watch movies or read books, you know, that's at $199, that's, you know, the perfect gift. So iPads are very versatile. They do a lot of things. If you want something that's a little bit more limited and much cheaper, you probably want to go with something like an Amazon Kindle Fire.
Well, let's move on to video game consoles. They're expected to be a big seller this year, and The PlayStation 4, the Xbox One, they both hit the market in the last month. What can you tell us about those systems?
Yeah, this is a very unusual year. Last year we had the Nintendo Wii U debuted, and this year we have two big console launches, both within a week of each other, which is very, very unusual. These, the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3, the predecessors, you know, were 7, 8 years old. So this is the first, you know, next generation set of consoles that we've had in a really long time. They're pricey. The Xbox One is $500. The PlayStation 4 is $400. And that's with one controller, no games. You know, you're going to be paying tax, you're going to be paying for an extra controller, you're going to be paying for accessories probably, and the games are $50, $60. So these are not for casual gamers. These are pretty much for the frontline hardcore gamers that want to play, be the first to play Call of Duty on these next generation consoles and play a lot online. So I would recommend these for really hardcore early adopter gamers. For more casual gamers, I would kind of stick with you know, the older consoles or the Wii U, which actually the best game I've played all holiday season isn't on either of those. It's Super Mario 3D World for the Wii U, and that's not even on either of those new consoles. So there's a lot of hype and a lot of excitement around the Xbox One and the PS4, but it's very early. There are very few games, and they're still very expensive, so you got to think about that.
Do you have a sense if somebody's really insisting on getting one of the two new ones, if one is, say, more kid-friendly than the other?
Well, if you're going for kid-friendly, I would go Nintendo, honestly. But of the two, I mean, they both have you know, parental blocks and things like that. The Xbox One is making some people leery because it comes with a camera. It comes with a Kinect kind of always-on camera that's always watching you. And that might make it easier for kids to control. You know, they can use voice commands that the camera will recognize them as they walk into the room. But some parents might find that a little creepy. They
yeah.
might worry that their kids, you know, it's going to be recording their kids and putting stuff online. Microsoft has fought really hard to kind of combat that perception. But, you know, you are going to have an always-on camera in your house, you know, facing you in the living room all the time. And some parents might worry about that. The PlayStation 4 is, from my view, seems more geared toward older gamers. There's not a lot of kid-friendly games on it so far. There's great action games, great shooter games, but I haven't seen a lot of kid-friendly games on the PlayStation 4 yet.
I'm a big fan of going with the last generation stuff. You know the games are out there. You can see reviews of them. You can usually find them used. Is there a danger, though, of those being obsolete and running out of things to do with them?
Not really. And, you know, the biggest game of the entire year was Grand Theft Auto 5, and that's not on either of the new consoles. That's, you know, you have to have a PlayStation 3 or an Xbox 360 to play that. So, you know, people are still playing that game. There's still great new games coming out for both of those consoles. I think it's going to be about a good year or so at least before you start to see stuff peter out on the older consoles because they have huge installed bases. If you're a video game maker, you're going to want to make a game for the biggest audience possible. And right now, that's not the Xbox One or the PS4 or even the Wii U. That's the older Xbox 360 and PS3. That's what most people have in their house right now.
Well, moving on to smartphones, we see two top competitors are the iPhone and the Android phones. Would you recommend that people currently with an iPhone, is it worth it to upgrade to the iPhone 5S?
I think if you have anything older than an iPhone 4S, if you have an iPhone 4 or anything older than that, I think it's definitely worth the upgrade. The camera is much better. It's a speedier phone. It runs on LTE networks, which are much faster than the old 4G ones. It's definitely a good upgrade, and there's a lot of holiday deals right now. You can get an iPhone for under $99, an iPhone 5S or a 5C, you know, really cheap right now, especially if you trade in your old device. If you already have an iPhone 5, I would probably hold off until next year. I would wait a little bit. It's not that big of a step up from the 5 to the 5S. There's the fingerprint scanner on it, which is kind of neat, but you probably won't use it all the time. The camera's better, but you know, you really got to think about the 2-year contract if you're under that, and I would hold off if you have a 5.
We heard from a listener named Jen. She's wondering, her parents are 91 and 92 years old. They just email and they do Google searches. Should she get them a desktop computer or something else that's higher tech but easy to use?
That's a good question. I mean, a lot of it would have to do with what they already have and what they're used to. I mean, you don't want to introduce something that's going to completely throw them for a loop and that they're not going to be able to get used to right away. You know, you want to get something that they'll be up and running. If they already are used to a desktop PC, you might want to think about a laptop that's maybe a little bit lighter but runs the same kind of software, or a tablet even. I mean, if they're Windows users, A Microsoft Windows tablet might be good that can run the older software but also run, you know, kind of touch-friendly tablet stuff. I found people, you know, above 60 really tend to like the Amazon Kindle devices and also really gravitate toward the iPad. You know, the iPad would be a completely different experience, but it's intuitive enough that I think they would probably get it right away.
Omar, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy holidays.
You too. That's Omar Gayaga. He's technology culture reporter at the Austin American-Statesman. First, a look at the difference between health and health care.
America spends more than any other country on health care, but when it comes to health, our next guest says the U.S. isn't seeing a full return on its investment.
Back in 2011, two public health researchers published an op-ed in the New York Times laying out that paradox and explaining that there's a lot more to health than just the health care.
After getting an overwhelming response to their article, they've published a book called The American Healthcare Paradox, Why Spending More is Getting Us Less. The authors are Elizabeth Bradley and Lauren Taylor. Elizabeth Bradley joins us now. She's a professor of public health at Yale and director of the Yale Global Health Initiative. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
So explain the paradox to us. How much more does America spend on healthcare? And how less healthy are we compared to other industrialized countries?
Great. Yeah, we spend double what the average other high-income country spends on a per capita basis. So where we might spend about $8,000 per capita on healthcare, other countries that are at our same income level really might spend $3,500, $4,000 per capita. That might be okay, except when you look at our outcomes are truly not as good. So, for instance, our maternal mortality rate is 6 times as high as in Sweden. Infant mortality rate's very high. And it's not just these public health outcomes. It's also some of the medical outcomes, such as our prevalence of heart disease, our prevalence of adult-onset diabetes. These are also our disability rates are higher than these other countries.
Hmm. Why is that?
We have a lot of different hypotheses for why this might be, but the one that is novel and the one that empirically seems to be coming forward strongly in this book is really the way we spend our money for healthcare. When we compare the United States to the rest of the world that are high income as we are, we actually spend a lot less in the area of social services. We are using a medical care system to really address some of the social, economic, behavioral challenges in our society, which are the real determinants of these health outcomes. We spend the vast majority of our money on the healthcare system and less in the areas of education, nutrition support, housing, safe parks, etc. And the other countries that we compare ourselves to and want to compare ourselves to are doing just the opposite. They're actually spending more in those other sectors and much less than we are in healthcare, and they're getting better outcomes.
So draw the link for us, maybe a little bit more specifically. How can investing dollars towards social programs lead to better health?
You know, a good example of this is how we open the book with Joe. Joe is a person who is a 28-year-old with onset diabetes, and he doesn't have good housing situation at all. In fact, he enters his house every day from the backyard of a that's quite swampy, doesn't have the right shoes, etc. And he ends up living a life with poor nutrition, not great employment, has a few amputations. In the end of the day, he spends about $35,000, $40,000 on health care due to these intensive, very poor outcomes from diabetes. And we contrast that to some of the early interventions that could have been done. A good pair of shoes that would have kept his feet dry cost $50. So when we look at some of the fundamental ways that we keep people healthy, if we underinvest in those ways, it can end up landing in our healthcare system and ultimately creating enormous medical bills.
Why do we have such a division between healthcare and social services in the United States, do you think?
Such a good question, and we do spend a fair amount of time looking at the history. These are two sectors that have grown up completely independent from each other. And if we look today, very often the way the American medical care system is structured, it really has the concept of individualism. I myself go to a doctor, I have a one-on-one relationship, and that doctor will help me. And it is sort of very aligned with the American values of individualism. When we look at our social service sectors, they tend to be more aligned with the voice in America that is more collective, that looks at sort of how a society generally will use its resources to help the most people. And these attitudes, the values, the actual institutions that have developed are they're quite different. I think they play very much on sort of America's first voice and America's second voice. You know, the first we're most comfortable with is a really individualism model, and the second we're less comfortable with but is critically important is a more social and collective model. And the two just are not, they're not working in a coordinated way in our society now.
And we continue to hear debate even nationally about how to handle not just the healthcare system, but things like government assistance programs. And there's a lot of calls to reduce government spending in that way. What role do you think the government has in facilitating these types of systems that you're talking about?
One of the exciting things we found in the book were actually a whole set of experiments that are being done with, certainly the government is enabling them, but not strictly as government programs. These are delivery systems, they're agencies in communities that have come together really integrating some private sector models, some nonprofit sector models, and really community development. Certainly the government has to be enabling, the government has to have some kind of role. But however we tackle this integration of these two will have to be done in an American way. It will have to build, I think, to be sustained in our culture. It will have to build on the great entrepreneurialism and the great spirit of innovation we have that comes out of both our private sector and our nonprofit sector.
Does the Affordable Care Act address the problem sufficiently in your mind?
It's a beginning. It's a great beginning. One thing that's great about the Affordable Care Act is it will ensure everybody so explicitly and transparently will see as an American culture, what are we spending on health care? Right now, there are a lot of hidden costs that we just can't budget for, we can't plan for, we can't rationalize. If we really ensure everyone will understand the true cost of our health care system, it also sets a platform in which some of the new agencies, which are growing up right out of a private sector and nonprofit sector, those agencies now will be accountable for a population and their health. And if we do it right, I think there's great hope this legislation could provoke greater coordination between medical care and the social services. We'll have to see if we actually implement it that way.
Well, because health care may not be the most important factor of health, should the money for the Affordable Care Act be spent on other social services?
A lot of people have asked us this question, and just to get the facts, you know, when we look at some of the most devastating diseases, colon cancer, stroke, heart disease, adult onset diabetes, 70, 80, 90% of these cases are really socially determined. They're determined by our behavior. They're determined by the environment we work on. They're not determined by medical care. So that tells us we have to pay attention to these other determinants of health. Now, should that be done by the healthcare system, or should that be done by some of these other sectors? That, I think, can be varied depending on the community, depending on the leadership in the community. You could imagine an accountable care healthcare organization that thought heavily about the social determinants of health because it was in its best interest to worry about mental health, obesity, smoking, housing, education among the population it's in charge of, you know, whose health it's accountable for. So I think it could really work either way.
We're talking with Elizabeth Bradley. She's the co-author of The American Healthcare Paradox, Why Spending More is Getting Us Less.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you have questions or comments on the way that healthcare and social services are delivered, funded, and organized in the United States? Do you think there's more involved in making people healthy than just the healthcare itself? Are you involved in some kind of outreach trying to bring health education, health information to people inside or outside of the healthcare system? We'd like to hear your experiences and your thoughts. You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org.
We're continuing our conversation with Elizabeth Bradley about the American healthcare paradox.
And we'd like to hear from you. Why do you think the United States, as our guests say, spends more on healthcare but gets worse outcomes? Do you think there's more to healthcare, to being healthy, than just the healthcare? And what do you think about the way healthcare and social services are seen in the United States, are funded, organized, and delivered? You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org.
Elizabeth, you said earlier that spending more on healthcare doesn't lead to better health results, according to your studies. But where is the money going that we're putting into healthcare?
We do get a lot of outstanding outcomes. And in fact, if you think about it and take a look at the data, some of our outcomes in certain areas are much better than other places in the world. So what are those? Those are things like the number of people living with a kidney transplant, more than any other country. How about being able to see a diabetes specialist within 6 months of being, accelerating in your disease? We are faster to get somebody to a specialist than any other country. Hip replacements. The number of MRIs we have per million people, the frequency with which we give catheterizations for angioplasty, these kinds of highly technical medical care responses, the U.S. dominates. And these give us good and important outcomes. We wouldn't want to lose that. The question is, can we get that, and can we still have a mind to some of the broader determinants of health that really are sort of the bread and butter that keep us healthy? And that's where we don't probably have the mix exactly right. If we look at other countries, we're unable in those other areas to achieve what they're able to.
Well, in fact, you compare the U.S. to Scandinavia in your book. What are some of the comparisons and contrasts?
Well, there are a lot of differences in how Scandinavia really organizes their health and social services, and more importantly, how their populace understands their own health. In Scandinavia, which when I say that, we visited Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, which are the social democracies of Scandinavia. And in these countries, there really is a conception of health that is the whole conception of health, that we want to be healthy in order to have a good life, to be able to have our vacations, to be able to work healthily, to have a good family, et cetera, that they see it as on the way to achieving, you know, well-being overall, which is quite different from in the United States, where very frequently we'll drive by a billboard that says, your health is everything. Like, the specifics of your health is every last thing. It doesn't matter what else. You have to meet these standards of health. It's a very different conception of what makes you healthy and what health is. In addition, the way they organize their services is quite different. They organize at a county level, where they are budgeting for their social services and their medical care services as a single global budget that's transparently debated and thought through. How much do we spend where to get the biggest bang for the buck? And that's different. They have a more integrated way to look at it, which I think very much reflects that broader conception of how one creates a healthy population.
Let's take a call from Carrie in Milwaukee. Hi, Carrie.
Hello. There's so much to talk about here. It's just amazing. It's a great conversation. I'm a physical therapist. I work in the inner city of Milwaukee. And I totally hear what you're saying about social services. We wind up being the food pantry, the clothing store. We wind up helping people get immediate shelter if they're in an abusive relationship, because all of these things affect what we're doing. We've got patients who have, you know, they're wearing shoes that are two sizes too small, and they're diabetic, or they have horrible nutrition. Nobody's ever sat down and talked with them about nutrition. They're 300 pounds, and they have knee pain. Well, we can work on their knee pain, but if nobody's helping them work on these other things, then our money that we're spending towards helping them with their knee pain is wasted. So we have a whole global approach at our clinic, and we see that it works much better.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call, Carrie. What are your thoughts on that, Elizabeth?
Oh, I think it's absolutely 100% true what Carrie has said, and we heard it again and again from clinicians. And both ways, both the ways in which clinicians were really focusing their time on these, and in fact, we know from our RWJ report that actually physicians generally say that one out of every six of the prescriptions they write, they'd like to write for a social service. It's that intensive that this is something they really see as being fundamental to keeping their patients healthy. We also saw the other side of this, where frontline providers became frustrated with it, just because they're trained in medicine, and they need to be the clothing store, as Carrie has said. And they don't always feel that they can actually do their jobs unless they're in one of these communities where there has been good coordination. So, in fact, the medical care providers, for instance, are able to very simply and easily understand what the shelter system is in that town or that community, or what the food pantry is, or the Meals on Wheels, et cetera. And in those kinds of communities, you really, I think, felt the joy of clinicians that they could look holistically, assigning sort of the right kind of interdisciplinary staff to the right kind of problem. What we often see, unfortunately, though, is the isolated clinician that is sitting there with the problem, knowing this is not medical, and just frustrated and, you know, depressed that they can't themselves use their trade to make this patient healthy.
Well, has the medical community evolved in a way that invests more training in these areas for new healthcare providers?
It's a good question. I think that we're seeing a panoply of types of providers that are starting to move into this area. Clearly nursing, you know, fundamental physical therapists such as Carrie, social workers, physician's assistants, primary care physicians. But we do face the problem in the United States where our medically trained people, medical physicians, do tend to go into the specialties. And if we look at the United States compared to our other high-income countries, we have a lower percentage of primary care physicians than many of these countries. And studies have shown that really, at the end of the day, hurts us in terms of some of these primary care outcomes. So I think there are a whole set of experiments happening, but we probably need more in that area.
Brett from Richland Center is waiting for us. Hi, Brett.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the air. I kind of have a question and a comment. You just mentioned experiment. I'm a study coordinator with a project called the Active Aging Research Center. It's a federal grant given to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, 5 years, one in year three. And our purpose was to develop some technology and see if it can help older adults in particular be able to remain in their homes and independent. I'm actually just coming home from a home visit right now. We're doing a randomized control study, and it's just been very interesting with this project to kind of see that firsthand. And I'm in a rural area. It's also going on in Milwaukee and Waukesha to get different kind of demographic perspectives. But one of the things with this project, when we started out, we wanted to see what assets the community has to be able to kind of use that to kind of support itself. And here in a rural area, we found so much that it's doing. We have doctors that are connected in the community, and we found out that the social support, informal and formal, is so important to have in place. I work in the Aging and Disability Resource Center here, and they're kind of making it a challenge to not only provide services, but also give back and get connected to a community. And they've been able to then get people connected, because I read in a study in AARP, people who are lonely and isolated, which often as people age becomes more of a reality, the more they're connected, the better their health outcomes and quality of life will be. So it's just been really interesting with this study, seeing how technology can help facilitate that and help with that. But I want also to have a question for you. With that, do you think doctors are connected enough with communities, or see that as an asset to help people become healthy? So we provide services, but how often are we really seeing the community's assets, and as doctors or hospital organizations putting efforts towards that to really holistically provide for people in a community setting?
Such a great question. And first, I think it really is important what you're doing. And the field of aging has really led in these areas, because exactly as you said, gerontology and geriatricians really understand the idea that, as you said, the social support can make a huge difference for people who are older. We have a great story in the book about a woman who was terribly lonely and called the ambulance every 2 weeks. She ended up, not because she was sick, but she was lonely, and so the ambulance would bring her to the hospital. Of course, you get to the hospital, you're an older person, you are going to have a full workup. She ended up spending $30,000, $40,000 a year on this, when really she needed a different kind of thing. She needed adult daycare, or she needed a home care worker, or maybe she needed a technological connection with somebody. So I wholeheartedly agree with what you're doing, and I hope your study will come out positively. In terms of our doctors connecting up, we found some really exciting areas in which this was happening, in Santa Monica, in Seattle. I think there are pockets where this is really happening, but not enough. And you got to sort of, I think, from a physician's point of view, it's a funny thing because I think you get so overwhelmed with what's coming through the door that it almost, even though you know it would be better to step back and make the connection so that ultimately there could be some prevention, where do you get started? So I think this is something that, you know, we're hoping the book will shine a light on this. So at the end of the day, it's easier for everybody in some ways. As you said, the community assets are the fundamental assets. And it's not clear we're using them to the best way we can. And wouldn't it be a shame if we're spending a ton of money in the medical care system and then kind of wasting community assets that, if coordinated, we could leverage?
Elizabeth, you presented these findings of your studies and some suggestions for improving the healthcare system and the social services that that complement our health. What obstacles are you running into in terms of getting those suggestions implemented?
That's a good question. Well, I think it's always hard when you're trying to raise awareness about something. One of the things is that we can't just come at this from revising the medical care system or a government system or social services. People also have to sort of understand and adjust expectations about what a medical care system does for one. And that's hard for all of us. You know, we all would rather, you know, pull on the diet pill than actually go out and get exercise. So this is a hard message, I think, for all of us to promulgate and for people to absorb. And that is true in any kind of culture shift. So that's one issue. The other issue that really needs to be talked about is the truth is we have a very profitable medical care system. And it's 18% of the largest economy in the globe. This is the largest industry in our world. And it benefits a lot of people financially and also, you know, for those who are looking for high technology specialty care are benefiting. And we're used to it. It's our habit now. We've been building this system heavily since the 60s. And it's tough for people to imagine it being different and potentially being fearful of what could happen in the long run to their own income stream. This is something we do have to talk about. And, you know, is there a way to do this that can be a bit win-win? That's what we'd look for.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Bradley is a professor of public health at Yale and director of the Yale Global Health Initiative. She's a co-author with Lauren Taylor of The American Healthcare Paradox, Why Spending More is Getting Us Less.